The day's biggest stories, the people behind the headlines, the conversations you won't hear anywhere else. I'm Christy Strasser. You're listening to Odyssey's On Deadline. Let's talk record highs and lows. As in the number of kids who sought a vaccine exemption to start kindergarten were at a record high, and the number of kids who will mingle with classmates while vaccinated to protect themselves from exposure to illnesses that were eradicated decades ago, that's at a record low. Here's WCCO in Minneapolis.
New CDC data shows vaccine exemptions climbed to 4.2% during the 2025-2026 school year. That is up from 3.6% the year before, and nearly double the 2.2% from just 5 years ago. So why aren't kids getting vaccinated? Well, the data shows most exemptions are actually non-medical reasons, such as religious exemptions. And it comes as the country is dealing with a record-breaking year for measles cases in the last 35 years. The CDC says the percentage of kindergartners getting the MMR vaccine, which protects against measles, mumps, and rubella, slipped to 92.4%. And that is below the 95% experts say is needed to maintain that herd immunity.
And Minnesota state health leaders are trying to get the word out to get those children vaccinated before the start of the school year. Epidemiologist Ben Christensen says they've seen numbers go down both nationally and here in Minnesota.
For example, with measles across the country in the last couple of years with increasing numbers of outbreaks. And so we're working with our local public health partners and healthcare partners to get the word out about the importance of these immunizations before school starts.
According to the CDC, 92.4% of kindergartners in the latest school year were vaccinated against measles, down 2.5 points since the start of the COVID pandemic.
Measles cases are on the rise. Here's what you need to know. I'm medical editor, Dr. Brian McDonough. We're starting to see these cases sporadically. It's rapidly moving. Measles is spread through coughing, sneezing, droplet nuclei, and it can stay in the air for a couple hours. So you literally could be somewhere where somebody with measles was and not even know it and pick it up. That's the fear we have. Initially, somebody has a high fever, they have a cough, they get a runny nose, watery eyes, kind of like flu-like symptoms. One of the tips is you can get these things called Koplik spots, which are like these white spots inside your mouth. But the big thing that really shows up that really changes the picture is you get a rash. Children with measles, a certain percentage can get not only very sick, but they can get brain damage and it can even lead to death. And they're the ones we worry about. You know, the best protection still is getting vaccinated, and it's a safe vaccine. We've been using it. We've tested it for years. And all of a sudden, what we're doing is we're consciously taking something away that can protect our children and protect all of us. You know, parents, I think in their heart of hearts, they want to do what's right for their child. Of course they do. And they're afraid because they've heard so many different rumors and things. And that's the problem, trying to get the real information out there.
Keeping track of your kids' vaccine history is one job of a parent. But there's also keeping track of their digital footprint. Here's Tommy Tucker in New Orleans with how far you're supposed to go.
Half of the parents in the United States say they sometimes go through their kids' phones. Do you? Where's the line between snooping, giving them privacy, and keeping them safe? We'll get some answers. Talking to Dr. Judy Hoag, licensed clinical psychologist, host of the Savvy Psychologist podcast, our longtime friend. We're going to talk about parents and smartphones, although we're really talking about phones and mental health here for the most part, aren't we?
Of course. Everyone's favorite topic.
Tell me about how they can negatively impact kids.
Well, the thing is that phones are just so high stimuli and things are happening so fast and people can scroll and switch in between content really fast and also simultaneously look at a bunch of content at the same time. And what we know about developing brains especially is that it will oftentimes impede the proper development of our executive functions and our attention stores. So even as adults, you know, we may feel sometimes overwhelmed by all of that. And as children, because the brains are still under construction, it has a bigger impact that could end up carrying into other things that they need to do throughout the day, the tasks that they need to complete, and also just contributes to a sense of feeling overwhelmed, rushed, like there's just too much going on at the same time.
And even phone is a misnomer because it's really like carrying a little computer around with you. That's what we're talking about.
Exactly. I know. It's so complicated. I still remember when we had, you know, rotary phones in the home.
No,
really,
you don't.
Phone,
you
right?
might remember
yes,
push button.
Do.
You don't remember rotary phones.
I had a rotary phone when I was very
really?
Little growing up in Taiwan.
Oh, no
yes.
Kidding.
There's a picture of me with it when I was like 4 years old.
So it's not all bad. It can be good, right?
Of course. I mean, phones, you know, again, like you just said, phones are a little computer. So there's a lot that we can accomplish with our phones. But I think a lot of people are not necessarily using their phones for productivity. And even sometimes the productivity apps on a phone can get kind of overwhelming. Like there's just too many things happening.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, phones help us keep in touch. Phones help us to stay on top of the news and any updates. All those things are great, but I also have people complaining that they feel like they're too connected. Like sometimes they really just want to be away from their phones, but people always know how to reach them even when they're on a vacation, you know, and this applies to kids too, right? I mean, maybe they are trying to just, you know, have a nice day with the family, but, you know, they keep checking Instagram or TikTok to see what they're missing because they know that their friends are out today and they're worried that their friends are doing something super fun without them. And that contributes to anxiety and that feeling of FOMO that a lot of people complain about.
And as far as super fun, I'd put that in quotation marks because, you know, 12 seconds might look like super fun, but that's just 12 seconds out of God knows how much, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that that is, unfortunately, you know, you fill in the blanks, right? You see the 12 seconds on a reel or on a TikTok video, but you fill in the blanks of, oh my gosh, you know, and when the camera's not on, they're saying this or doing that, and I'm missing all of it.
It's just like a TV program is what it is, and I don't think kids realize that. Is there something parents can do or should do, like at what's age appropriate for a child to sit down and say, look, now, here's the deal. What you're watching is not real. In a way it is, but in a way it's not, and at some point, they have to have a reality check, right? It seems like earlier would be better than later.
Oh, definitely. But I think that it can be tough, right? Because sometimes when you have that talk with your kids, they think that you're the one who's out of touch. You have no idea what they're going through. And, you know, to an extent, they're probably right. And also, once you start to talk to them in a sort of, you know, I got to talk to you, this is a lecture kind of way, they just kind of tune you out. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's, you got to find that right approach. And I think so much of it really revolves around staying curious and being curious about their habits, why they use the phone, you know, why they're interested, but not making it seem like an interrogation and seem more like a conversation where you're trying to learn about their interests, why they use the phone, why it's important to them, you know, what they think the benefits are. I think that it has to sort of bridge that feeling of I'm getting a lecture from my parents to, oh, my mom and my dad, they just really want to know about my life.
As you say that, I'm just thinking about the conversation, how it's evolved through the years with the phones. And you know, I've been watching Breaking Bad and what's the other one? Better Call Saul. And they got their old flip phones, right? And you think about how much that's changed with the iPhone, a smartphone. And then the concern used to be with predators and young people, and it still is. But now it's almost the threat is not as much a predator as much as it is just the social backlash, right? One way or the other?
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of times people are thinking about, you know, of course, those dangers, those big dangers that you just mentioned. But it's also the fact that with our phones, we're constantly feeling connected to anything that might be going on, any potential gossip, people bullying you in the comments, you know, making snide remarks, making you feel bad about yourself. And sometimes they're even sending things more in a direct message. Or if you're using Snapchat, whatever mean thing they said about you, it goes away after a period of time and you can't even track it. And so I think that all of that adds up to a lot of pressure and could have really significant mental health consequences, especially for our young people, because at a certain age, we care about peer influence and we care about peer interactions much more so than we do as adults. And that's that time when all these comments matter so much more.
You have a soon-to-be 5-year-old, right?
My child is 4.5.
Soon to be five.
I mean, he already is feeling some. Yeah, he's about to be five.
Exactly.
You know, he's already feels. Yeah, he's going to be five in November. So yeah. he already has feelings of social pressure and influence.
Like, really?
You know, well, why can't so-and-so play with me longer? Well, we're at a play date, but he's spending more time with the other kid, you know, things like that. That's already happening at his age.
How do you go about introducing the whole thing with a child to a phone? Is there any data that shows there's an age that's appropriate or not, or does it depend on the child?
I think it really depends on the child. And I was actually having this conversation, interestingly, with my child's optometrist last week. And, you know, she has a toddler and she's like, well, any parent who can not give their kid any screen time, kudos to them, because I don't know how that's possible. That's probably pretty hard to do. She's like, but more importantly, if you're trying to protect their eyes, and she's talking obviously about their eye health, she's like, well, you just want to keep things at a certain distance, you know, make sure that they're not looking at it too closely. And of course, like, take breaks. I think that every family is going to have their idea about this, because there are health and mental health effects of having too much screen time too young. But I also think that when parents judge other parents for having their child use screen time, you know, that's not very helpful, because I think that most people need it just to get a break. Like, if you want to wash the dishes or clean up before bedtime, you know, you need to have, you know, YouTube babysitter maybe for like 20 minutes while you're doing all of that. And so I think you have to watch your child. And if your child is showing signs of distress when you try to take away the phone, the YouTube, they're protesting too much, they're starting to act out of sorts, you know, that kind of shows you that they're having some kind of an addiction to it.
And do you check their phones? Because again, back in the day, it used to be, let's check to see what you're looking at, predators, keystroke programs, etc. But now it seems as though the conversation has shifted from that to bullying and your friends trashing you on social media.
Yeah, definitely. And it can be really tough, because there's a new app coming out all the time, and it's just impossible for you to always be fully informed on everything that's going on. But, you know, there are some websites for parents to know about kids' apps, basically. And I don't know that they're always going to be 100% ahead of the game, but there's several different websites that essentially educate parents about the kind of apps that are out there. There's also some parental control apps to manage screen time and how they access things. But, you know, I think the most important thing is, if your child is living under your roof, then there has to be certain rules. Like, I can check your phone anytime I want, and I need to have passwords to all of your apps. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to ask, because it's your money, it's your house, right? They're living with your rules. And if they want to have a phone, then as a balance to that privilege, you need to be able to have access to anything that you want to look at. So if you know, of course, it doesn't prevent them from trying to delete an app before you go and look at it. But still, if you're looking at their phone and you're trying to get into an app and you can't open it, you know, you can request that they put their password in so you can look at it. And I think that that's very reasonable. I don't think that that's overbearing, because I think that you need to have parental monitoring. Parental monitoring is one of the biggest predictors of good functioning in children and adolescents. You know, just the fact that you're on top of what they're doing and you're asking questions.
On the topic of kids and tech, what do we need to know about AI? Here's WWJ in Detroit.
I'm on the AI committee for South Lyon Community Schools.
Okay, how long have you been in education?
This will be my 14th year this school year.
Okay, wow. All right, so kind of talk to me about the committee a little bit. You know, when was it formed? What brought about the need for it? And what kind of things do you discuss, you know, when you're having a meeting with it?
Yeah, so it formed not this summer, but the summer before that. We started doing work because South Lyon Community Schools decided that they wanted to implement AI, not just to teachers, but to students, and roll that out. As far as some of the things that we talked about, we, you know, were able to go to a few different conferences to see how other districts were faring, because there were quite a few other districts, even in our county, that had rolled out AI, you know, the year before us. So we wanted to see some of the things that worked for them and some of them that didn't. We worked on drafting a bill of rights for both teachers, students, also parents, of some of the expectations of things that you should not do with AI in different different circumstances. We also revisited it, especially after it was implemented for students in second semester, to see if there was anything that we needed to change in either the Bill of Rights or the Student Code of Conduct, having to deal with plagiarism and AI, and they are planning on having us meet next school year as well, because as you know, AI is something that's constantly changing. It's constantly getting better. So we, you know, you have to adapt, or, you know, it becomes, you know, not up to date, and then it doesn't do any good for anybody.
I have to imagine that AI has made things somewhat complicated, you know, for someone that's been in education for as long as you have.
Yes.
Especially now, I'm sure there is plenty of ways where it's made things better and also brought about new challenges to how students do their work. So you said you talked to some other districts and things like that. You know, what did you find? Just a couple of examples, like what did work and what didn't work? Just what stood out to you?
So I did find, like, with talking some of the other districts, that some of the people that were drafting these Bill of Rights, they had really, I mean, as odd as it is to say, the more that they kind of made it a little bit more approachable to parents, like with visuals and things like that, of like, hey, this is when you should use AI, like a flow chart almost, this is when you shouldn't, it seemed to work better than the other districts that had, you know, Bill of Rights, which is good, but like they didn't make a Cliff Notes version. And so when you throw something like that, that's that dense and that's heavy at people, like, they're more apt not to read it. So making sure that people are informed and making easy, accessible ways to do that definitely worked. As far as what, you know, what it's made better and what it's made worse, I don't know if I'm jumping the gun here. But as, like, you know, with my experience, I feel like there's a lot of things that are really cool with AI. You know, being an English teacher, there's a program where I can upload a rubric and previous examples that I've given A's to for certain portions of a paper. And the kids, while I'm peer editing one-on-one with them, if they can't ask me a question because I'm with another student, they can upload their paper onto that particular AI program and basically kind of get a mock-up of what I might have said and, you know, what they would have gotten on that particular portion of their paper based on what I fed into it.
Wow.
It's cool. But then you obviously have the plagiarism issues and kids, you know, being very smart about finding ways to make it so that the AI detectors don't detect that they actually used AI to write their papers, but the teacher kind of knows because they know that student's writing that this isn't their work. And then what do you do with that? And that's a very gray area that not just South Lyon, but a lot of schools are trying to navigate right now.
Brittany, has there been any effort to turn back the clock a bit, like go back to paper, pencil, older tech, kind of devolve it all to help students? Or are you just kind of full forward, you know, this is the future, we're moving that way?
So there definitely has been. You know, it depends on the teacher. I will say for English and social studies, math and science are affected as well, but I feel like English and social studies have been hit the hardest so far. At least it really seems like from, meetings with that committee and from experience. So there are teachers that are strictly going back to, we are going to be taking, you know, tests, writing essays in class, pencil and paper, that's it. And then there are teachers that take it the opposite direction. And South Lyon has taken the stance of, you know, not forcing AI on teachers. So if they want to use it, they can. But if they don't, they don't have to. So some teachers, old and young, take the stance of, I don't want it anywhere in my classroom. I don't want to use it. I don't want my students to use it. Others, like me, I feel like, are a little bit more in the middle. Like, it has some really good applications, but then there are times and places for it, so that there are going to be times where we don't use it. So there's definitely a pushback, you know, just in our district from some teachers that are like, you know, you shouldn't have let them be able to use it, but at the same time, they were using it anyway. So it's, again, it's a very, like, complicated issue.
You know, over a dozen years overall, do you think the advancement of tech has been more positive or negative in general when it comes to educating students?
I like to take the stance that it's been more positive. To me, AI that's going to be a tool that kids use outside of the classroom, whether it's for, you know, daily, like applicable things, or it's in their area of work. So I do think that it's definitely to their benefit to expose them to it, so that they, you know how to use it roughly. They know what to do, what not to do, not to share your personal information, for instance, with, you know, an AI chatbot or things like that, how to cite it, how to give it credit for doing parts of things. I feel like those are skills that a lot of kids are going to need to learn how to use once they get out into the workforce, and colleges are even adapting as well. Like I know U of M, actually, I was working with a student that their college app essay was that they were told by U of M to like ask AI for a prompt and to have it give an answer back to them and to respond to that prompt. So again, like this is not just something that high schools are struggling with, it's college and it's the workforce. So them being exposed to it's probably a benefit, but you know, to say that there's not some drawbacks would also not be true.
That's a lot about young people, but there's a place where they intersect with older people, and that place is housing. Housing they need, but that older people are clinging to. And who can blame either side? Here's KCBS in the Bay Area.
With few options to downsize, older adults simply are not leaving their homes even after their kids have grown up and moved out. Chris Thornburg, real estate industry analyst and founding partner of Beacon Economics. Are you finding that older adults are staying in their homes longer? They're not downsizing?
Well, yes. And to be clear, there's both a long run trend in this direction, but it's become particularly bad over the last few years. Look, ultimately, when you think about having enough housing stock in the state, it boils down to really two things. A, are we adding enough new housing? And the answer is, as we know, no, we're not. But of course, the second question is, are people able to move depending on life changes, whether your kids have moved out or whether you have you have a new job or something like that. So we're talking about housing market liquidity to allow people to spread among the existing housing stock in a very efficient way. Well, there too, we have this long run problem. Think of all these older folks with no kids in the house who have a 2.75% 30-year fixed rate mortgage that they refinance back in 2020 or 2021. Again, for these folks, it's vastly too expensive to move because their current cost basis is just too low. And that has really added a whole other element of complexity and, if you will, problematic sort of structure to the California housing market.
Well, I mean, ostensibly the idea is, all right, you have a, I don't know, four bedroom home and the kids grow up, they move out. Well, to save money, you downsize maybe into a townhome or a condo or something like that. But the problem is those smaller units are now more expensive than the place where you're living.
Well, they are more expensive because you're going to have to get another mortgage at a higher interest rate, correct? That's the real issue. It isn't so much, I mean, look, the property values of every property have gone up. That's just a function of demand relative to the limited supply in our supply-constrained state. But when you think about those other type costs, the interest rate costs, your property tax costs, while they're low where you are now, they'll be high where you're going to move to. Ergo, you know, why would someone move to a smaller house that's going to end up being more expensive?
So, I mean, theoretically, you know, let's say the retired couple moves out of their big house, they downsize. That opens up that house for another family to move in.
Right.
So
right.
By the people staying in the big house, there's nowhere for that younger family to go. And maybe they had started their family in a two-bedroom townhome or condo, and they're not leaving there, and there's now no one to move into there.
Well, actually, they are going to move. Where they're going to move is to a four-bedroom house in Texas or Nevada, because a lot of families with kids are making that choice because there's simply not enough housing stock available here in California. This is exactly why you see the number of school age sort of children in the state falling. This is why school districts across the state are going to see very, very grim futures because they have enormous fixed costs, particularly with pensions, relative to a declining base of clients, if you will, otherwise known as students.
You analyze this stuff at Beacon Economics. I wonder, do people tell you flat out, listen, we would love to stay here?
We do hear these conversations about quote-unquote affordability. But what's amazing is that while our policymakers will discuss the issue of affordability, they never truly lean into changing the dynamics of new supply, changing the dynamics of housing liquidity. Take, for example, this new trend date of course, leveraging mansion taxes on the current housing market. That is to say, if you're selling a relatively high value piece of property, you're suddenly saddled with very high transfer taxes. Well, yet again, you're reducing liquidity. You're giving that older couple with a 4 or 5 bedroom house one less reason to go ahead and move to someplace smaller. And then we sit around and wonder why our housing market is so messed up.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Barry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.